requesting my presence, but is it mostly just going to be for study?
This is the last Diamond Sutra study.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to bow out. Right. I thought if there was any other thing going on. But thank you.
So we're going to cover 7 chapters today.
Where are we starting?
26 to 32. We did up through 25 last time, the foolish people. 26. Sabuti, what do you think? Can the Tathagata be seen by means of the possession of attributes? No, indeed, Bhagavan, Sabuti replied. As I understand the meaning of what the Buddha says, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. The Buddha said, well done, Sabuti, well done. So it is, Sabuti, it is as you claim, the Tathagata cannot be seen by means of the possession of attributes. And why not? Sabuti, if the Tathagata can be seen by means of the possession of attributes, a universal king would be a Tathagata. Hence, the Tathagata cannot be seen by the means of the possession of attributes. The Venerable Sabuti said to the Buddha, as I understand the meaning of what the Buddha says, the Tathagata cannot be seen by the means of attributes. On that occasion, the Buddha then spoke this gatha. Who looks for me in form, who seeks me in a voice, indulges in wasted effort. Such people see me not.
27. Sabuti, what do you think? Was it due to the possession of attributes that the Tathagata realized unexcelled perfect enlightenment? Sabuti, you should hold no such view. And why not? Sabuti, it could not have been due to the possession of attributes that the Tathagata realized unexcelled perfect enlightenment. Furthermore, Sabuti, someone may claim those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path announce the destruction or the end of some dharma. Sabuti, you should hold no such view. And why not? Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path do not announce the destruction or the end of any dharma.
Chapter 28. Furthermore, Sabuti, if a noble son or daughter took as many worlds as there are grains of sand in the Ganges and covered them with the 7 jewels and gave them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhans, the fully enlightened ones, and a bodhisattva gained an acceptance of the selfless, birthless nature of dharmas, the body of merit produced as a result would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. And yet, Sabuti, this fearless bodhisattva would not obtain a body of merit. The Venerable Sabuti said, but surely, Bhagavan, this bodhisattva would obtain a body of merit. The Buddha replied, they would, Sabuti, but without grasping it. Thus, it is called obtaining.
29. Furthermore, Sabuti, if anyone should claim that the Tathagata goes or comes or stands or sits or lies on a bed, Sabuti, they do not understand the meaning of my words. And why not? Sabuti, those who are called Tathagatas do not go anywhere, nor do they come from anywhere. Thus they are called Tathagatas, Arhans, fully enlightened ones.
be easier if I had a book.
Oh, 30.
30?
Furthermore, Saputi, if a noble son or daughter took as many worlds as there are specks of dust in a billion world universe, and by an expenditure of limitless energy ground them into a multitude of atoms, Saputi, what do you think? Would there be a great multitude of atoms? Saputi replied, so there would, Bhagavan. So there would, Sugata. There would be a great multitude of atoms. And why? If a great multitude of atoms existed, Bhagavan, the Tathagata would not have spoken of a multitude of atoms. And why, Bhagavan, this multitude of atoms of which the Tathagata speaks is said by the Tathagata to be no multitude. Thus, it is called a multitude of atoms. Also, Bhagavan, this billion world universe of which the Tathagata speaks is said by the Tathagata to be no universe. Thus, it is called a billion world universe. And how so? Bhagavan, if a universe existed, attachment to an entity would exist. But whenever the Tathagata speaks of attachment to an entity, the Tathagata speaks of it as no attachment. Thus, it is called attachment to an entity. The Buddha said, Saguti, attachment to an entity is inexplainable and inexpressible. For it is neither a dharma nor no dharma. Foolish people, though, are attached.
31. Chapter 31. Yeah.
Chapter 31.
Yeah.
Hold up. I'm supposed to read?
Yeah.
Okay. And how so? Smriti, if someone should claim that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self, or that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a being, a view of a life, or a view of a soul, Saputi, would such a claim be true? Saputi said, no indeed, Bhagavan, no indeed, Sugata. Such a claim would not be true, and why not? Bhagavan, when the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self, the Tathagata speaks of it as no view. Thus, it is called the view of a self. The Buddha said, indeed, Saputi, so it is. Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path know, see, and believe all dharmas, but know, see, and believe them without being attached to the perception of a dharma. And why not? The perception of a dharma, Saputi, the perception of a dharma is said by the Tathagata to be no perception. Thus, it is called the perception of a dharma.
32. Furthermore, Saputi, if a fearless bodhisattva filled measureless infinite worlds with the seven jewels and gave them as an offering to the Tathagatas, the Arhans, the fully enlightened ones, and a noble son or daughter grasped but a single four-line gata, this teaching on the perfection of wisdom and memorized, discussed, recited, mastered, and explained it in detail to others, the body of merit produced by that noble son or daughter as a result would be immeasurably infinitely greater. And how should they explain it? By not explaining. Thus it is called explaining. And then there follows a four-line gata. As a lamp, as a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning, view all created things like this. All this was spoken by the Buddha to the joy of the elder Saputi, the monks and nuns, the laymen and laywomen, and the bodhisattvas, the devas, humans, asuras, gandharvas, and the world, all of whom were greatly pleased with what the Buddha said. Thus ends the Diamond Sutra. Chow Ming calls chapter 26, the Dharma body is not an attribute. Thich Nhat Hanh calls that a basket filled with words. The Buddha said, who looks for me in form, who seeks me in a voice, indulges in wasted effort. Such people see me not. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddha. Considers this an important chapter because he says we must make just as great an effort to look for the Buddha where the 32 marks are absent. In stagnant water and in beggars who have leprosy. When we can see the Buddha in these kinds of places, then we have a signless view of the Buddha. The 32 attributes include such things as level feet, the thousand-spoked wheel sign on feet, long slender fingers, pliant hands and feet, toes and fingers finely webbed, full-sized heels, arched insteps, thighs like a royal stag, hands reaching below the knees, a well-retracted male organ. Height and stretch of arms equal. Every hair root dark-colored, and on and on and on. Those are some of those blue eyes. Jaw like a lion, eyelashes like a royal bull, and so on. So those that look for the Buddha with those attributes do not see the Buddha. In fact, Sheng Yi says that as our practice encourages us to do, when we cultivate, because Zen practice is rich in cultivation, as is in tea, as is in violin making, violin performance. When we cultivate, make sure you don't become attached to appearances and forms. Some people practice with such diligence they acquire powers and see lights or flowers or other wonderful forms. There's gain. There's something there. There's some... It's good. Cultivate. And they think they are enlightened. But all such, Sheng Yi goes on to say, but all such scenes are related to one's practice and are very, very, very far away from enlightenment. We should not become attached to anything we see or smell, taste, touch, think, anything we make. Thus, an old Zen master once said, better nothing than something fine. Better to see the leper and his Buddha nature than to make something fine. There are two kinds of Buddha Dharma. There's the provisional relative, worldly truth, and this is where the attributes are visible. The other is the ultimate final truth. The first one is important because it encourages us to cultivate. our practice and cultivate and look for the attributes and work hard and be diligent. And it's important because it leads beings to cultivate the path of merit. But the second ultimate truth represents the path of wisdom, and it has no attributes. So how do you see a Buddha nature in a leper? With no attributes. Those of us who use Buddhist terms without conveying the full teaching of the Buddha should wash our mouths and ears out. Without afflictions and suffering, we cannot make a Buddha. The beautiful lotus grows in the mud. So to me, this chapter, the fundamental question is what is the real Buddha? And as the old Zen master said, better nothing than something fine. Any comments? Chapter 26.
I will in just a moment here. What else could attributes and form mean besides the list of the 32 attributes?
Well, the forms are countless. Forms are how we got show. Do we got show with our elbows down at a 45 degree, or do we go horizontally? If you're like this, maybe you're doing it wrong. Maybe if you're doing it this way, you're doing it wrong, according to persons that are attached to form.
So form could be a way of doing things, or it could be a physical object.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, I think this is typical in most monasteries. You know, they talk about out of a monastery of 1,000, maybe one is a Buddha. All the rest are following the forms. He's not doing it very well. Neither is he. I'm doing it. I'm good. I can do it. I can sit full lotus. You know, I'm good. I'm really good.
You're good.
I'm really bad at the same time.
So part of this sounds like a either or, but neither. You know what I mean? It's this whole topic or the whole of what I've heard in the last, this is my third study group session. It sounds as if the logic is, it brings you to a kind of collision in the mind, and with the idea that the mind sort of drops out. Can the mind hold two contradictory statements at the same time? So I think it's a sort of clash of logical moments.
Mm-hmm. And then
good.
What happens?
You're good, you're bad.
Then what happens?
There's nothing to say at that point.
Do you end it, stop in confusion?
I don't think this
is... You say, oh, okay, well, we're there, so what do you do?
Well, I think you have to rest on it. It's not something you can just swallow in one sitting. to sit with it.
How do you mean sit with it?
You have to go through and read and reflect and digest and discuss. And I'm not speaking for myself. I don't know.
And experience?
It has to go from, I guess, from here to here.
And here? Out your ass? Under your feet? Down the drain? So how do you see a beggar? How do you see the Buddha nature of a beggar or a drug addict or homeless person? How do you see the Buddha nature? What attributes do you see? Do you see the homelessness? Do you see the deformed hands of the leper? Do you see the fine calves and the sharp pointed high heels of a good looking babe walking the street? One has a strong repulsion, one has strong attachment. Mm-hmm. What's she like in the sack? Instead of what she like as a human being. She's cultivated her protoplasm. So those calves look pretty, have good tone. And yet, in the midst of that protoplasm, where is that Buddha nature? What is that Buddha nature? Who is that Buddha nature? Why am I looking or not looking for attributes? So I see this as a stationless, positionless, formless aspect.
Did you say stationless?
Stationless.
Oh, that's a good word. That's good. I like that.
I'm remembering back a long time ago, before Aubrey was born, and my husband and I practiced Nichiren Daishonin Buddhism at that time. And there was a children's book that was written by the leader of that sect. And I don't remember the name of it, but it was the best thing that I took from that particular practice. And it was about, I'm trying to remember, a moon princess. And the idea was that each person, and I know we're trying not to talk about people as separate beings, but in a way, each person has a reflection, a celestial reflection, and it's that reflection who you talk to. And I tried to put that in practice in my teaching, and it was just amazing to talk to the Buddha in each person, no matter who they were. It was an extraordinary practice. And that was a children's book.
Wow. Amazing.
Anybody else? Barbara? Judy?
Said quite beautifully. I love the gatha at the end of that chapter. Yeah, that's about it.
Greg? Any comments on chapter 26?
Well, I'm impressed with this, the whole sutra, because you're getting hammered again and again and again about paradox. And so it seems to me, this is hardly original, I'm sure many people would feel the same way, that evidently the not just the intellectual but the emotional understanding of paradox is really crucial. So, you know, it's possible, I suppose, intellectually to say, oh yeah, it's a paradox, la-di-da. But still hold it at a distance from oneself, you know, at the intellectual level. And so I'm wondering what the emotional insight into paradox would be. Probably very, very transformative. Unfortunately, I don't think I'm there yet. But ultimately, it must be equating. Now, so I'm thinking all the various paradoxes there are. I mean, our lives are sort of like from morning to night full of paradox. But the classic the big. The big kahuna, is that what they say, of paradoxes must be life and death. So you would have to argue, well, we have this paradox of life and death, but according to the Dhamma Sutra, there is no life and there is no death. So how could there be a paradox? But it's very, I must say, it's a very unusual approach to teaching. Hammer on this, on paradox again and again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it is, right? It's hammering on the paradox again and again. Well said.
Mm-hmm. That's probably the most stubborn part of us, huh? I mean, we could say, well, look at how bright it is, even though it's cloudy. It's bright as daytime, you know? But then there's night, right? And Buddhism negates them both, as far as I can tell.
Negates neither.
Or neither, yeah.
Or neither, thank you.
Well, it's a warm feeling to me, the emotional. It feels warm.
Warm?
Or it's expressed as light a lot, but for me it feels warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's more that, somehow. A temperature thing, for some reason.
So I assume that you're meaning it's a comfortable warm.
Or yeah, it's not hot. It's warm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the Lotus Sutra, there's a parable about a blind-born beggar who assumes that many, many things do not exist because he can't see them. So he assumes that not only do they not exist, but no one else can really see them either. And then an amazing physician, and this is who symbolizes the Buddha, goes to the Himalayas and finds four different kinds of medicine that, among all of them, will cure anything. And gives them to this blind-born beggar. And then the blind-born beggar can see as we can see, but has no experience with the seeing. And so he assumes that everything that he can see is the infinite that he hadn't been able to see before. And he tells everyone that he is the wisest person in the world because look at all he can see. And then the teachers talk to him and say, you have just begun to realize how to use this vision. For instance, you can see what's in the room, but you can't see everything that's outside of the room. You can see what you can see, but you can't see everything that's beyond that immediate perspective. So I think that applies here a little bit when we think of this as a paradox. From where we sit, it looks like a paradox because we have maybe just a little bit of wisdom. But if we could see farther, we would see how it's unified. Hmm. And for instance, how day and night are unified if you look at the whole planet.
Yeah, you look down on the planet and you say, why don't those people get it?
Oh, you mean down there in Australia or something?
Or down when you're circling the Earth, you know, and you're looking down and you see how the whole thing works and you say, oh, down that part there, it's currently in the shadow and the other people are currently in the sunlight. They think the shadow is nighttime. It's just a shadow, you know. So they have a different perspective, which may not be complete either. But yeah, it's nice to be removed. See the eclipse. Thanks. Chapter 27. It ended with the destruction. Those that are what does the end of 27 say?
Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path do not announce the destruction or the end of any dharma.
They do not announce the end of any dharma.
I don't quite get that.
And actually, how Thich Nhat Hanh translates this, he says, one who gives rise to the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind does not contend that all objects of mind are non-existent and cut off from life. All objects of mind are non-existent and cut off from life. A bodhisattva does not contend that all objects of mind are non-existent. That objects of mind are non-existent and cut off from life. Now, Red Pine's version talks about the destruction of the dharmas, which seems a little different. But it's kind of hard to...
Object of mind instead of dharma.
Yeah.
So I don't see any difference.
Okay, good. Yeah. So those... Red Pine, part of his commentary says, those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path do not announce the destruction or the end of any dharma. I guess that's the end of that chapter. And Thich Nhat Hanh says not to cut off from life. So my rendering of this is liberation is not to cut ourselves off from existence and to pick and choose, to grasp and reject, to hold dear and then exclude. Liberation practice includes everyone and everything. And that's, to me, is one of the beautiful things about being here at Jikoji, is this is a temple. And it is the tone set by the founder, Koban, was to be open to all things and all beings and welcoming them all. And then we come here and practice and we pick and choose and say, yes, yes, this is good. No, be gone, when that's our role as residents, whether it's part-time, full-time, provisional, tabled, to be determined former is fundamentally to caretake. And the Buddha caretakes.
What is the be gone part? You mean weeds or something? Weeds be gone?
People be gone.
People?
Irritating people be gone.
Oh, really? I didn't know you made any people go away around
it's
here.
It's natural. It's natural for people to just pick and choose. And when you pick and choose, like I remember in the third grade at recess time, you know, it's time to go out and play kickball. So Bobby and Frank were the two best athletes in my third grade class. And so they were the captains, and they'd start picking who were going to be on their side so we'd play kickball. There were times when I was like third picked, and I was like, oh man, I feel so special. But there were many times when I was second to last or the last. And the last, some of you may know how that feels.
The horrors of elementary school.
So to pick and choose. So when you pick and include, that's what the Buddha did. He included everyone, including murderers. Right?
Well, do you mean that the residents of Jokoji are falling short of that idea because they exclude some people, or?
It can happen. It's happened. It's happened in the past.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, is that falling short, or is that not just in what embodiment is?
Embodiment of
the Buddha.
To exclude?
Yeah. In a body, we're in a body. We have to exclude some things.
We do.
Or we couldn't be in a body.
Like exclude.
All right.
You know, there are times to include and there are times to excuse.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But, you know, the classic tale that ended up wonderfully was from the Old Testament, from Genesis, where Joseph, I think he's one of the youngest sons of Israel. Of his father's name was Israel.
Ready?
And his brothers, he was his father's favorite. And the brothers did not care for him, you know, because he was the dad's favorite. So they sold him into slavery. And then years later, you know, there's famine in the Promised Land, and some of his of Joseph's, so he was sold into slavery and went to Egypt. So the brothers go to Israel or go to Egypt because, you know, they're short on grain and they need some resources, and they're going looking and finding, and they meet this guy, a vicar.
Vizier.
Mm-hmm. Like Brazier?
No, V-I-Z-I-E-R.
Vizier.
Mm-hmm. Brian.
Hey, Brian, we're in Diamond Sutra class. Could I call you back? All right. And can I call you tonight at, say, 7:30 or 8? Is that too... Okay, do that. Okay, thanks. So, this vizier receives these guys, Joseph's brothers.
So he was like the highest civil servant in the whole land.
In that area where these guys arrived. And the vizier recognizes them. They're his brothers. Joseph was sold into slavery and he becomes a vizier. And he sees his brothers. And he takes care of them. In fact, he sends with them back home extra donkeys and provisions and a request that Israel's entire family of 80 move to Egypt to leave the famine. And so they do. But the brothers eventually find out that this guy is their brother, that they sold into slavery. And they just fear, you know, this guy is going to just... But he doesn't. So here's a guy who is scapegoated, who is rejected, excluded, and yet he turns around and he embraces his family with just all the wealth that he has. Then there's another story of seven fairies that were part the mom and the aunts of this beautiful young princess that was born. And the mom fairy invited all the sisters but one. And that one came and cast a spell on the baby that it would die at the prick of a pin. Because she was not invited. So part of being excluded and rejected is the feelings of, it can be rage, it can be frustration, it can be depression, and it's long lasting. It is long. It can be long, long, long lasting. So be careful about excluding. You have anything?
I get the message.
I'm going to propose at the board meeting that the residents no longer be called residents, that we're caretakers. That is what we are. We're caretakers of this temple. We are not residents. We do not own this place. I've owned property before. I do not own this place. None of us does. Not Brian, not Michael, not Hollis. Colvin did not own this place. This is a temple where amazing stuff can happen. Welcome, Ian.
Is that Ian up there?
Oh, my goodness.
Amazing stuff just happened.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey. Don't let me interrupt, please.
You want to sit down?
Sure.
And join us?
Yeah. Oh. Kendra.
So we're on to chapter 28. Red Pine says, acceptance of the selfless, birthless nature of Dharmas. This fearless Buddha Bodhisattva would not obtain a body of merit. Buddhi says, but surely this bodhisattva would obtain a body of merit by all the wonderful things that he does. And the Buddha says, yes, he will obtain a body of merit, but without grasping it. Thus it is called obtaining. I don't see too much paradox there. Maybe. I mean, there's grasping, but it's like when you grasp, is it available?
Mm. So to grasp is to keep it to oneself, whereas to obtain leaves it open for everyone.
Something like that.
Or that's what it means. Mm-hmm. So it says, thus is it called obtaining. In other words, obtaining mm-hmm. means gathering but not grasping. That's what it's saying.
And Thich Nhat Hanh says, we all know people who cannot bear great suffering. But we do not realize that to fully enjoy great happiness also requires great strength and endurance, which is kasante, one of the paramitas, endurance, vigor, energy. To be happy requires a lot of endurance, a lot of strength, just like to suffer does. And usually you think, oh, relieve me of my suffering. Whatever a bodhisattva thinks, says, and does can give rise to limitless virtue and happiness, but he or she is not caught in this. We wash dishes and we, this is Thich Nhat Hanh, if we wash dishes and announce that the dishes are done, you know, in that fashion, our work is a waste of time. And washing dishes, to just wash dishes, brings an estimable virtue and happiness. Then chapter 29 is the utter stillness of perfect deportment. Chao Ming calls this chapter of a Tathagata, neither coming nor going. Tathagatas do not go anywhere nor come from anywhere. I think that's really encouraging to us. Us, the Tathagatas, we each have that to not come or go. It's just funny, you know, taking a shower, you know. I'm going to the bathroom, and suddenly I'm in the turn on the shower. It's like, I was just doing this yesterday. Did I go anywhere? Did I come from anywhere? It just seems weird. We're just always right here. As Rush Limbaugh said.
What?
He gets it right sometimes.
No, couldn't possibly.
What did he say?
Did you ever notice that wherever you go, you're there?
Always there.
He said that?
Something like that. And I thought,
gosh.
Anyway.
I also saw that on a bathroom wall in a men's room in India. Wherever you go, there you are. So I guess Rush was there.
A lot of hippies there.
Gets around.
It's the drugs talking.
Chapter 30 is the meaning of the concept of entities. And Thich Nhat Hanh titles this chapter The Indescribable Nature of All Things. The Buddha said attachment to an entity is inexplainable and inexpressible. Attachment to an entity is inexplainable and inexpressible. For it is neither a dharma nor no dharma, and foolish people are attached. But it just, to me, that goes to just one of the fundamental, you know, just fundamentally, just attachment to an entity. It could be this. Even attachment to this is inexpressible. Once you begin looking at it closely, Thich Nhat Hanh says, if we base our understanding of reality on our concepts of particles, atoms, or composites, we are stuck. We must go beyond all concepts if we want to be in touch with the true nature of things. Beyond all concepts. It's funny, you know, when I come here on weekends, I've been busy all week doing stuff, and I come down the road and I look in this valley and I see this great place, and it's like, wow, what is this place that we are so attached to? You know, we're passionately attached to this place, and I encourage this passion because it's just, it's our work ground. And we've been leaderless for weeks and months. Mato's been the leader here on a daily basis. You know, but Michael's been gone, so the leader's gone, and you've stepped in and helped so measurably. And it's just, to me, it's just one of the cool things about this place is at any one time, there's a very unique set of people and circumstances like it is today here. And in 10 or 12 days, you're gone, so this place will be different. And Monday, I go off to work, the place will be different. The people were here today, your friends that came for your talk, and they're gone. And while they were here, it was very special and unique. And your mother-in-law was here. And it's just, it. So while we're here, the passions have us work hard to take best care as we know how. But I think one of the gifts I'm given is to be able to leave and come back. Leave and come back. And it breathes a lot of oxygen into burning up any concepts I have of this place, because every time I come back, it's like, what's going on here? What is here? Who's here? What's the vibe? How is it today? And is it, how is it for you coming here this time?
Well, it's nice to be here. Just came from Santa Cruz Zendo to Angie's house to hear a little Buddhist tour. All seems rather fitting.
You come and go from time to time. Time to time.
Yes.
How is it when you come back? Do you wonder about this place, or does it feel like, oh, I'm home again?
A little bit of both. No, you were talking about not liking the term residence, and sometimes there's this term, you know, permanent resident, which always bothers me, because I don't see that there are permanent residents here. There are residents who stay a long time, maybe, but I don't think anybody's permanent here.
And I've never liked that term, permanent resident. It also implies some kind of ownership. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a permanent resident. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've developed a view of the residence that's a little bit larger than life. I have this incredible respect for people who are caretakers here. Doing something that I never did, I feel, in my life. Giving up, you know, whatever the kind of daily life routines of our culture, and devoting yourselves here. Maybe it's my idea is inflated, you know. Maybe I've kind of cooked this up for myself. I don't know. But words residents and caretakers doesn't even begin to touch it for me. You know, what's going on here? What you people do?
Any word is inadequate to express it.
Yeah.
I agree.
The other thing what you were saying about coming and going from this place that I don't think of it so much as this place, but like even though I view the Sangha as larger than the practitioners of Buddhism, going in and out of, especially today, I noticed from my mom's house to Carolyn's sitting group, and then to a coffee shop, and then to Angie's. And so there's this kind of moving through different groups of people, and the ones that congregate around the Buddhist practice places, there's a different feel than people who don't. And a kind of a different intention, I guess, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And all the people at Carolyn's place were like full of light, you know, and open. We get out in the world, and even though people are generally nice in Santa Cruz and Taos and so on, but there's a kind of more of a more layers, more stuff, more agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Even though when you're stuck here, all that stuff appears, but when you go away and then come back, you see how much less it is.
Ah, that's
in
a good way to put it.
Like
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for being such nice people.
It's fun to hang out together. So chapter 31, second to last chapter, Chao Ming calls it not giving birth to concepts and views. And Thich Nhat Hanh calls it tortoise hair and rabbit's horns. So in Red Pine's discussion, he talks about how for bodhisattvas it's important to know, see, and believe all dharmas. Know, see, and believe all dharmas. But know, see, and believe them without being attached to the perception of a dharma. So I think this is one way to deal with the paradox. Know, see, and believe all dharmas. Negate none. Embrace all. But without the perception of a dharma.
Without the perception of a being. So it goes right back to first precept.
You mean the first chapter? First precept?
First precept.
No killing?
No killing. Mm-hmm. No destroying dharmas, no destroying beings.
Which I guess is also the triple treasures, to not violate the triple treasure. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
So how do we view the Sangha? Do we view the Sangha as concentric circles? Or do we view it as maybe a focus close to where we are, and then it goes out and it's kind of diffuse but not layered? How do we think about Sangha?
How do you think about Sangha?
I think about it, I go back and forth between two views. I think about it as centered where I am, because that's where I can see the most, and diffuse out from there. But then when I think about it, I think it's more continuous and more even. But not limited.
That's kind of how I see it when I'm at work. You know, I downtown San Francisco, get out of my truck, walk down to the, walk. You're riding with me, we walk down the street, and we see 2, 4, 6, 10 people camped out against the cyclone fence on cardboard, sleep in the night, wrapped up. So we see that, and then we go get to the coffee shop and have our donut and coffee. You head out, and I head to work. And I see the girl with the nice calves and high heels, and I wonder what's beneath that protoplasm within that, as well as guy in a pinstripe suit that's walking very, with a leather suitcase, a lawyer. But then I'm making distinctions, and I'm in trouble already. But it's just amazing, just the vastness of the community that's there. And people don't see it as a community, but when people are trying to get safely across the streets, there's a community of safety in that. Mm-hmm. And
the fact that you can cross the street without getting killed.
Yeah, and like the other day, I was one guy was heading off to work, and we were both walking across the street. I could see him looking that way and this way, and we knew that the light was already going yellow and there weren't any cars. But we were all both very careful. And then we stepped out, and I said, yeah, this San Francisco is the highest fatality rate for pedestrians. And he says, yeah, it's not usually not the pedestrian's fault. Somebody running a red light. So it's like somebody in a hurry. They're late. They got to get there. They can make it. They can see six lights down. They're pedal to the metal. They're going. And then somebody steps out in front of them, and their life's forever different. I've been lucky. I haven't done that. My dad did. When we were in India, his driver killed a pedestrian, and it just devastated him.
So, you know, but what I was feeling was this is the Sangha in a way. But yeah, it feels like it. I mean, I'm thinking of New York, and which is that a couple times greater, maybe. And there's one guy that my friend knew who lived across the street from her was driving around in a motorized vehicle because he couldn't walk. You know, he was making better time than we were. Mm-hmm. And all these cabs, you know, who would just assume, looks like they just assume kill you is look at you, but You know, and I'm just sort of saying to her, well, don't kill us, you know, don't kill us, we're okay. And is there sort of agreement among everyone that allows us to cross the street and keep going and be okay, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's a sangha too.
Yeah, and sometimes it's very mindful. Sometimes it's really mindful. That's what's fun about being in a place like that, is to be on a corner with people and you can get a sense of the vibe and how people are willing to be if they're agitated or not. I don't spend that much time on corners. I do work too sometimes. Any other comments on Sangha? Thich Nhat Hanh. The Buddha gives us an antidote to dualistic thinking. He says that all dharmas, including self, person, living being, lifespan, non-self, non-person, non-living being, and non-lifespan, are concepts. We should not let go of one set of concepts just to be caught up by another.
Mm.
He says that someone who gives rise to the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind should know that this is true of all dharmas, should see that all dharmas are like this, should have confidence in the understanding of all dharmas without any conceptions about dharmas. Full confidence in the dharmas without any conceptions about them. And then he goes on to say, once we understand a concept is just a concept, we can go beyond the concept and be free of the dharma that concept represents. So just reminders that dharmas, that we're holding on, picking. To a concept that we can let it kind of evaporate. Because how many concepts are in your back pocket, John? How many concepts can you fit in your back pocket?
Well, I just had my pockets expanded to a tailor, so it's kind of private. It's kind of a man's question. I get the point.
No, I just...
It's endless.
It's endless.
It's totally endless.
But
it's like worlds within worlds. I mean, it's that kind of feeling.
But, and they weigh nothing. That's where I was heading to, because you know, your pockets might be really big, but they don't. A concept sure doesn't weigh very much. Otherwise,
we give them weight.
That is true.
That's where
the problem.
That's where the worlds within worlds. You know. We add the...
And it's fun to give them weight, because when you're in argument, you know, you're giving your concept weight. And sometimes you can bludgeon somebody with that concept.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
In an argument. A good lawyer will do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, does my sitting practice... Does my non-sitting practice too, when I go out and work and when I'm digging on a stump or something, does my practice make me kinder?
Who's that monk or somebody that said, let us not pursue the truth but release our cherished opinions? Somebody said that. I'm not sure who it was.
Find out. Let me know.
Have you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
I
might have been Hakuin. I'm not sure.
Who?
Hakuin?
Hakuin?
Something. Don't pursue the truth, but let go of your cherished opinions. Seems to be a...
The last chapter, the teaching of the Dharma, how to explain the Dharma. And I think this is for teachers.
For what? I beg your pardon?
For teachers. You know, how do you explain the Dharma?
Oh.
And how do you explain the Dharma? By not explaining.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And explain would mean to bring it out and to make it plain, which would mean that you can grasp the whole thing yourself, you can lay it out piece for piece, and we really can't do that. We can explore it, but we can't explain it.
Thich Nhat Hanh says, being in touch with suchness is like digging a well and reaching the point where the water forces its way up. You're digging down, 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 down. Finally, you break through and it just starts flowing in. Once we can drink directly from the well of understanding, we are no longer caught by the signs, by the attributes. We are no longer caught when we drink directly from the well.
That's beautiful.
But we each have to dig that well. And I'm kind of going sideways to digging a well. I'm digging a root stump instead of a well. So I'm taking my time and dig in that well of understanding. Because I think that root is more important. But that's...
That's you.
That's me. Thank you.
What is it more important than?
Than attaining enlightenment. It's more fun to dig out a root and figure out how that thing's going to rock out of there. It's just a blast. To me, it's like being a kid. And then I got come-alongs and jacks and lumber, and it's just like, I can't wait, you know, but then I can't do it because I'm encumbered with preparing for a class.
What are you going to do when if you find a root that's wrapped around the foundation of Michael's room?
There's no foundation around his room.
It's floating.
There are poles and other stuff, but yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm working on that one. So I got a lot of work to do before he comes back.
And the root becomes part of the foundation.
Yeah.
You know, that part of the root becomes part of
that,
the foundation.
So that part of the root would have to be left where it is.
Yeah, maybe. But
is that going to break your heart?
We'll see. We'll see how it goes. My brother that you met, he's an arborist in Carmel. And he came up here last weekend, and we hiked out to the ridge the first time he was here. He was here for my ordination 2 years ago. And he might be here next week, too. But he, you know, he's cut down a lot of trees. And I said, Brian, I got to show you this stump. So we go over there, you know, it's this big thing, and show how we're digging it out, and he says, Doug, why are you doing that?
Is he a Buddhist? Does he practice Buddhism?
He's a guilty Unitarian, because he doesn't go anymore. My mom is now in Carmel, and she does all the Unitarianism for the family, and so he doesn't have to go anymore. He's really relieved.
She's the Unitarian nun of your family. She's been sacrificed.
Self-sacrificed, yeah. Mm-hmm. At age 90.
Wow.
So, yeah. Well, that concludes the Heart Sutra for now. Is there any other comments?
The Heart Sutra?
The Diamond Sutra, excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you for
taking
us through this. It was fun on this journey. Yeah. Great journey. You did a lot of work.
Yeah. Hopefully people will revisit it, as I will, because it feels like I've just scratched the surface.
I think I'm going to buy that little book.
This is good.
Yeah.
Thich Nhat Hanh's is a... Mm-hmm. And I think it's based more on Khonsei's translation than
on Red Pines.
Red Pines, yeah. Who used a lot of Sanskrit texts. But Red Pine used commentaries from 53 Zen masters that kind of accumulated, and so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To have that vast a resource, and his glossary is good. Is there an index in there? I think there is.
No, there isn't.
There is
kind
no
of
index.
A limited one.
Okay. So that's one of the disappointing things about some of these things. Is you
I guess it's just a glossary.
Like, Cleary doesn't have indexes in any of his stuff. So.
Well, good luck with anyone who's going to try to index this kind of thing.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dad.
Yes, sir. Are you ready?
Yeah.